You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thord,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Catherine Schumann.
Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates. PubSite is the new easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. The Feisty Heroine Romance Collection of Short Stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution. Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Catherine Schumann on the show with me today. She has an amazing new book. It's called This Terrible Beauty, and this is a must-have for your bookshelf, let me tell you guys. Welcome to the show, Catherine.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm excited to have you. Catherine, we begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Well, that's an easy one to answer, actually, because I still have evidence of it. I wrote a book called How the Farmer Married Miss Schumann, which I wrote when I was about 6 years old in school. It's a hardcover, and it's illustrated. No, but seriously, I always wanted to write, and I have many, that's my first memories creating that particular book, but I was the kind of kid who sat at my mother's typewriter and wrote horrible stories about girls and horses and things like that.
How old were you when you made that book?
I was about six when I made that first book, which was a love story. And then I just kept going. So I really always wanted to be a writer. For a brief period of time, I thought I would become a journalist. And I did train to become a journalist, and I worked at NPR for a time. But I realized that really it's the long form writing that suits me best. And that my nature is not really ideally suited to the competitive world of news gathering and so on. So it's really been something I've been working at for a long time.
Gotcha. When, you know, being the precocious little kid who would, you know, make her own books and, you know, hard bind them and everything, did your parents or anyone else in your life encourage you? Did they notice this, you know, odd gift that you had?
Well, they certainly did. And it's funny, actually, because my parents are German and they speak very good English, but, you know, with a strong accent. And so when I was younger, particularly when I was a teenager and we had some rough years, I would always, you know, just outspeak them. Like I had a way with words and they would stand there dumbfounded. And they always said, oh my God, you should be, you know, a lawyer or something. Cause I could just argue them down on any topic. But in fact, being a lawyer is not what is suited to me. It's actually being a writer where I get to use words, and wield them as weapons if I so choose. But I also had a lot of teachers who encouraged me and had just that right combination of being kind of tough, but also loving, which is what I think every writer needs.
And it's so I hear this kind of story over and over and over again on the show, that, you know, that this one little piece of encouragement from a parent or from a teacher, you know, comes back to you over and over again, because there's some pretty lonely days of being a writer. And, you know, it takes nothing for an adult to give a little piece of encouragement. And you just have no idea how that's going to come back over and over again to help us through those tough times.
Well, that's absolutely true. And I do have a fifth grade teacher who I have tried to look up and I haven't been able to find her. Her name is Penelope Nelson. And she encouraged me so much. It was this moment when I left America and moved to England. And my grandmother had just died. And, you know, I was moving to a new country. And she just really encouraged me to sort of be myself and trust myself. I was only 10 at the time. But I took those lessons with me through into adulthood. And I can't tell you how often I think about Penelope Nelson and wish I knew where she was so I could just say, hey, you know, you were my fifth grade teacher. And honestly, even now, I'm grateful to you for the way you encouraged me.
Well, Miss Nelson, if you're listening out there, let's make an author stories connection here, and let's make this dream come true. Katrin, so you know, people told you that you were suited to be a lawyer and should do that, but you knew you wanted to be a writer. How did you start pursuing that when you got out of high school and thinking about, you know, what path your life would take and so forth?
Yeah. So I spent my teenage years in England, and I went to college in England at Oxford. And at Oxford, you have a very limited, or at least you did back when I was at school, limited choice of subjects. So I studied modern languages, which means French and German. So I was always interested in words and languages, but that was not focused on writing per se. It was more reading literature of, you know, 18th, 19th, 20th century literature and doing translation. And then when I graduated, I just knew I wanted to write. And I ended up at graduate school at Stanford doing a journalism degree, which was fantastic, really interesting, and taught me a lot about, you know, how journalists work and how to gather information and how to write under deadline and how to be persistent and all those good skills, thorough and persistent and truthful, and how to write good dialogue and so on. But then when I started working in that field after graduating from grad school, it didn't take me that long to realize that it was really not in my nature to kind of be cutthroat and to dig for the story. And I was more of a behind the scenes kind of person. And so I just started to marry those two interests and ended up developing a career in which I would do collaborative nonfiction writing. Like I worked on a whole number of nonfiction books, which is sort of, you know, my journalistic skills helped me in that endeavor. So I wrote and published a number of nonfiction books. And all along, I then also worked on fiction and always novels.
So I'm very interested in your history. You're the daughter of German parents, and I believe I read that you were born in Germany.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
And then you grew up in Brooklyn, and then also spent time in England, and then going to school in England and America. Having this sort of broad base of what you maybe consider home, how do you feel like that affects the stories that you write, or maybe the kind of outlook that you take in telling stories?
Yeah, I've thought about that quite a lot, wondering sort of, you know, where I get my interests and my drive and my sense of observation. And I think it's because I did always feel like an outsider growing up. I didn't have a difficult childhood by any means, but I never felt quite part of the pack. You know, it was always sort of curious to me, especially when I was a teenager in England. I always felt a little bit like I didn't quite understand the rules. So I think I became just a very observant person. I was rather quiet, but I also loved socializing. So I would watch and I would observe and I would kind of wonder what was motivating people. And so I think I have a deep interest in that idea of how we become who we are and how we can feel like we really belong. And in terms of my novels, what ends up happening is setting is incredibly important to me and kind of complicated. I can't really write a book unless it's set somewhere that I feel really connected to. And since I don't have that very strong sense of my own homeland, you know, I'm not English, but I'm very nostalgic for London because I spent 14 years there. And I lived in Brooklyn, but I'm not a Brooklynite. So I don't really have that strong sense of, you know, this is my homeland. And I guess that questioning comes through in my books. You know, I'm always asking questions and looking at things from a variety of different angles.
Right. You spent time, you wrote nonfiction, there's, you know, a few of those on Amazon. They seem to be family oriented. And, what was the draw there to write those books?
Well, I am a person who really likes to be productive, and I do love writing and I love to be productive. And what I discovered in my early days writing fiction is that I had more of an urge to see success quicker. And so I realized I could put my skills, my nonfiction writing skills, to use, and that would let me have a career where I was working on lots of different projects and that I could sell on proposals. So I wouldn't have to write the whole book. I could have ideas and I could collaborate with other people and I would be able to sell those books and see them in print. So the books that you're seeing on Amazon are the ones that were traditionally published, where I connected with other writers or people who had a platform or something to say, and then I would facilitate the development of the book and the actual writing. And it just happened, it was sort of accidental, I guess, but that a lot of my nonfiction books ended up being kind of about family dynamics in a very general sense. I then did quite a lot of work behind the scenes, ghostwriting and developing book projects that ended up being self-published by business people, for example, you know, or institutions and places like that. So that was a lot of fun for me, and it helped me feel productive, and I loved to flex my writing muscles, but it wasn't really what my dream was. All along, I would always noodle around with my stories and my fiction.
Well, and speaking of fiction, you published your first novel last year, The Forgotten Hours. I remember when this book came out and what a splash it made. The main character, Katie Gregory, is, and speaking of family dynamics that you talked about in your nonfiction work, this is kind of one of the craziest family dynamics that you can imagine.
That's right.
Katie's father is accused of sexually assaulting her friend, and then, you know, there's a trial and all that. He goes to jail, then he gets out. Tell me where this story came from. Where did the character of Katie Gregory come from for you, and how did you start following her on her journey?
So this story emerged for me way before the Me Too movement broke into a national conversation. And it was kind of triggered by a weird experience I had at a certain point in my life where I had two friends who were embroiled in the kind of consent and sexual assault issues, but on really opposite ends of the spectrum. And I went along with them on this strange journey. They didn't know each other, so they were unconnected. But I experienced this strange position where I was kind of what I came to think of as a peripheral victim, meaning that nothing happened to me. I wasn't assaulted, and I wasn't, personally involved in these incidences, but I was there on the front lines. I was watching these things unfold, and I felt very torn about, and these were very close friends of mine. I felt really torn about what had actually happened. And it became kind of an obsession of mine, how to figure out in instances like this, but also in other circumstances in life, can you always find the truth, and is there a single truth? Do people have different versions of the truth? And then also, I was really interested in the idea of loyalty. And that's really driven by my own personality, because I'm a very loyal person and I believe in loyalty. But what I came to discover was that loyalty can be blinding, and I wanted to explore all that in the book, and that's what I ended up doing through my main character, Katie, who as a young woman is really torn between believing her father, whom she loves dearly, and her best friend, whom she loves dearly. And I think people can relate to this on many different levels, whether or not it's this particular topic. Where do we find the truth, and what do we, how do we believe people and really come to know people for who they really are?
Right. Was this the first novel that you had written, or just the first one that you published?
It's the first one I published. I actually have a novel in a drawer, as many fiction writers
do.
Yeah, and that one I haven't looked at for a really long time, so I don't think that one will ever see the light of day. But yeah, I fiddled around with one novel for quite a while. The Forgotten Hours was technically my first, but first to be published, put it that way.
We talk a lot on the show about the gift of anonymity. The before you publish that first novel, no one knows who you are. No one's expecting anything from you. Save for a few family members and friends, maybe knows that you're even working on it. And then after that first one comes out, everything changes, especially when it's a hit and a success like This Terrible Beauty was, like The Forgotten Hours so then you need to follow that up. How did you take the success of the past and relish in it and soak it all up, but then come back to the blank page all over again where everything starts back to zero? Where did This Terrible Beauty come from?
Yeah, so This Terrible Beauty is kind of an interesting story because I've been working on it for a long time. I did not write it in the year between when I published The Forgotten Hours and now. I had been working on it for a while, and it just, I hadn't really massaged it into shape yet. And actually, I have to say what it did for me is it sort of took away a lot of the self-doubt, and I began editing with a certain reader in mind, and I found it actually very helpful. I was driven to try to pull the story together in a way that would be compelling for readers, and I knew that I had a certain challenge because it's a story that's set in the 50s and 60s in East Germany, and I knew that most of my readers were kind of going to vaguely know a little bit about the history, but really wouldn't know the details and wouldn't even know necessarily that they were interested in the details. So I understood that I had to create a kind of a narrative that pulls you in because of the personal stories and the characters, and then kind of surreptitiously teaches you a little bit or shows, reveals to you a little bit about what that world was really like. But I have to tell you, for the next novel, which I'm starting from scratch, there I think it's a little more challenging because, you know, there are definitely now certain expectations. I don't already have a first draft that I can play around with. I'm still just in that mode where I'm producing new material. And that's not a comfortable place for me to be as a writer. That's when I'm asking myself all sorts of questions about whether this is really, you know, has legs.
Right. So This Terrible Beauty was something that you've been working on for a while. Like you said, it takes place in East Germany. And you're very right. As someone who grew up during the Cold War, I feel like that I know, you know, quite a bit about what the world was like then and what, the geopolitics were. My kids, I had to explain to them one day that there was a time when Berlin and Germany were split, you know, and that, and, you know, it kind of blew their mind. But yeah, you bring out details that, that I didn't know. How personal of a story is this for you? I know that your parents are German. Is there a connection here for you, or did this just seem to be a great tapestry to paint on?
No, there's a strong connection on many different levels. So growing up, I had heard various stories from my parents and, you know, I did think about what it meant to be a German, in the respect of this conversation around the guilt and, you know, the Germans were the bad guys and I'm German. I'm a German national. Does that make me a bad guy? You know, I had thought about it in those kind of abstract terms. But then when the wall came down, I went with my father to Rügen, which is an island on the Baltic in the north. And Rügen fell behind the Iron Curtain, just, you know, by chance of fate, basically. And that's when the story really became personal for me. When I saw that island, we snuck into a fisherman's cottage that was derelict that had belonged to my father's great aunt. And it just struck me, like really almost physically, when I was in this space. And I thought to myself about the families and the women in particular who had tried to make a home in this kind of environment. And these German women who had first endured, suffered through fascism. And then at the end of the war, when they had many of them lost their sons and husbands and brothers and lovers, embraced communism because it kind of offered like an option for redemption for them. And it just made it feel so personal to me. Like, how did they get through that? And what were their hopes and dreams? And how did it all play out? And then it so happens that, you know, my aunt lived on the island and she had to flee when they took away all the property from the homeowners. So she left with her three young children. You know, so there are a lot of real stories that I heard that don't necessarily make it into the book, but that gave me that kind of the confidence to know that I was writing about something that was really meaningful and honest and had happened in kind of recent history.
Well, and you really bring those struggles alive to us in the character of Bettina Hellstrom. How did she come to you, and did she come fully formed, or were you thinking more about the situations and a character embodied those for you?
I sometimes wonder myself where Bettina came from, because she did come to me kind of fully formed. And I
love
knew
that when that happens.
Yeah. And I knew pretty early on who I wanted her to be and her main conundrum. I knew what that was going to be. The fact that she is a woman who's sort of stuck at the end of the war and she ends up marrying out of convenience, but she's not a bad person. She's trying to make the best of a bad situation. And so then I just started asking questions around that, like what are the consequences when you have those sort of choices, those compromised choices? And it always was pretty clear to me who she was as a person. And also even her husband, Vanna, who, you know, nominally is the bad guy in this story. But I sort of understood him and felt pretty sympathetic toward him. And I wanted to get that across too.
Well, there's so many people that I connected with in this book, that it's not just Bettina's story, but then you also let me kind of feel that pain, through her husband and, you know, then through, I guess we can say that, if something happens with her and she's forced to leave, and there's another character there that we, you know, get to kind of go through that turmoil with all over again. I love the way that you, kind of give us a glimpse through each of these eyes. How difficult was that to not just paint all of these characters as two-dimensional characters, but to let us see the good and the bad through all of them?
Well, I do think that that's a theme that plays out in all of my fiction, is this idea that we are complicated, nuanced human beings, and that it's dangerous to put people into silos. You know, this person is bad, this person is good. I mean, not to say that there aren't, you know, bad guys around, but I think I'm very interested in that gray area, in what makes people behave in certain ways. And I think for me, it's a matter of getting in their heads and just having kind of empathy for them as human beings. And so even when they do things that are selfish or maybe just even downright wrong, I seek to explain the motivation so that even if you can't excuse people's behavior, you might have some understanding of what motivated them. And I think it's really interesting. You know, I think in an alternate life, I wouldn't have been a lawyer, but I would have maybe been a psychotherapist or something like that.
Well, you know, we tend to judge people on their actions, but then we want to be judged on our motivations. And it's nice to be able to see that in other people and explore that. And I think it makes us more empathetic to the people around us.
I hope so. And one of the questions I had when I was writing this book was, you know, for authors, we're always thinking about point of view. You know, what is the point of view in the book and who is telling the story? And, you know, it's important not to get overly complicated and to sort of find the right voice and the right person to tell the story. And in this case, at one point, I had three points of view. I had Bettina, the main character, and then her husband, Vanna, and then Peter, who is the man that Bettina falls in love with. And so what I ended up having to do was decide, did I really need all those points of view? And for a little while, I was wondering whether I needed Vanna's point of view at all. And then I'm really happy that I stuck with telling some of the story from his perspective, too, because I think that helps me achieve or get closer to achieving what I was hoping to achieve, which is sort of getting you to understand more deeply how power can corrupt somebody, and why bad, quote unquote, bad people behave the way they do sometimes. And that touches on the bigger issues, the bigger themes about politics and our yearning for power and control and so on, that was behind some of this book too.
In historical fiction, this time period, or, you know, especially World War II, is ultra hot right now, and lots of people are exploring these times and characters that live there. And I think it's wonderful, because we're losing so many people from that era, and keeping those stories alive is certainly important. I love that you explore the fallout after that period. And because we tend to jump from World War II up to kind of modern times, and we forget how tough it was for so many people, and what it means to really rebuild and to find life after these big events. So I really applaud the work that you've done in this book. It's magnificent.
Well, thank you. I mean, I did feel pretty strongly that this is a story that I haven't seen very often. As you say, there is a lot of literature on World War II, and you know, and the Germans are the bad guys most of the time, and I totally understand that. You know, and that's appropriate. I mean, you know, there's a time and a place to look at things from different angles, and it just felt to me like now is an interesting moment, and people might be open to thinking about the ordinary German citizen who wasn't overly political, wasn't particularly involved, you know, just found themselves in this environment, in this world, and suffered for years through the war, led by this, you know, madman. So what happened to those ordinary people who you can't really assign blame to them necessarily just because they're German? And I felt like now is maybe the time that we can think about that and talk about that and see even how it maybe relates to our world today on multiple levels.
Well, the book is called This Terrible Beauty. It's there are links to it in the show notes of this episode. Katrin, the book is available in Kindle edition. Is it trade paperback that it's also in?
It's also available in hardcover and paperback. And
nice.
Audio.
And yeah. Audiobook, I was going to mention. That's wonderful. It's available everywhere now. I highly encourage everyone to go grab a copy. Katrin, if people are just learning about you and want to dig into all the great stuff that you do, I know you've got a great blog where you share writing advice. Is there a place where people can connect with you online?
Yes, if you just go to my website, so just Google my name, Katrin Schumann, and my website has all that information, including lots of links to the books and the research that I did for this book, and then, as you mentioned, all blog posts that I've collected over 7 years of writing, posts on writing experiences.
Excellent. Katrin, this has been so much fun catching up, and we wish you much success on the new book.
Great. Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
And have a waiter bring him a martini, which he would down before he hit the...
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
The near future. Humanity.
Structure of story and things like that, but I really enjoyed the creative process.
The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information and found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, It landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course, wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class, he thought.
Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app?
He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked.
You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa.
Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub. The blue of the morning rose behind him,
where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to
it. So things you write now, do they differ in the writing process from
plants? Looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller. "You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire?" the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?" he asked.
He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow paddy.